on Unsolved Mysteries.
Welcome to the renowned Comedy Store on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. Many of America's most famous comedians got their start at this popular club. But some people say that on certain nights, you're likely to catch a very different kind of show. One guaranteed to create a lot more chills than chuckles. Is a Comedy Store truly haunted from the basement to the rafters? Tonight, we've come to the legendary night spot to see for ourselves. Join me in this ghostly profile, as well as these intriguing mysteries. Keith Horne was a young man with everything to live for. So when the police announced that his sudden, shocking death was a suicide, Keith's family began their own investigation. Today, eyewitness testimony and questionable evidence has left them more convinced than ever that Keith was murdered. When she was just 16, Wendy Radcliffe found herself all alone in a moment of terrible crisis. But in the midst of Wendy's tragedy, a kindly stranger stepped forward to comfort and console her. Perhaps someone watching tonight knows the identity of Wendy's unknown Good Samaritan. Also, Keely Shea Smith joins us from the phone center with a poignant update. See how your calls reunited Fritz Vinken with a soldier who helped teach him the true meaning of Christmas. Stay with us for another fascinating hour of Unsolved Mysteries. If America's heartland is in the Midwest, its funny bone is here in Hollywood at a Sunset Strip nightclub called The Comedy Store. For more than 20 years, the club has played host to legendary comedians like Richard Pryor, film and television stars Jim Carrey, Roseanne, Jay Leno, and Arsenio Hall each got their big break while delivering knockout punchlines to the club's delighted fans.
If it's him right here, no, that's Don King. Okay, where the one I'm at? I'm pulling the fight.
But some say the best show takes center stage when the crowd goes home and there's hardly a living soul around. According to many employees, past and present, the Comedy Store's hallowed halls are haunted. Author Laurie Jacobson, who once worked here as a waitress, collected the stories for a book about ghosts in Hollywood.
This place is haunted from the basement to the rafters. When I was a waitress here, the waitresses would have to set up the showroom by putting tablecloths on the table, and we would put an ashtray on every table. And we would set up an hour before the customers were due to arrive. On occasion, girls would set up the room, leave for a moment, come back, and everything would be put back. The tablecloths would be refolded and stacked. The ashtrays would be stacked. And we all knew exactly what we were dealing with here.
Dave!
That what was happening in those rooms, being set and unset, was being done by ghosts.
It wasn't a figment of my imagination. I wasn't drunk. I wasn't high. I didn't get hit in the head with something and, you know. It's easy to know once you've seen it, you believe it.
When he was just starting out, Joey Gaynor worked as a doorman at the Comedy Store. Most nights he was the last one out of the building, or so he thought.
It's about 3 o'clock in the morning, everybody's out. I'm locking up and I go into the original room to get my coat, and there were 2 candles lit on the table. I blew them out. Turned around, they were lit again. went back over and I said, man, I blew them out again. I said, well, maybe they stayed a little lit when I blew them out. And I started to go down the stairs and it was freezing all of a sudden in there. And I turned around and candles were lit again. And so I said, okay, stay lit, goodbye. And I just split. I didn't want to hang around to find out why.
It seems the Comedy Store spirits just love to play games with Joey Gaynor.
One night, I was going to shut the lights in the building. It takes 4 seconds, 5 seconds tops. Walk back out, chairs, all these chairs are just piled in the middle of the aisle, piled up. And I never heard anything. Nobody could have come in and done that in 5 seconds. Even if it had been 10 seconds, if you compile 8, 10 chairs in that amount of time, you should be in Vegas, because that's pretty amazing.
Born and raised in Georgia, and I fought in Vietnam. That's like being punished for the same thing twice.
Like Joey Gaynor, comedian Blake Clark served a tour of duty as a Comedy Store doorman. Blake says he, too, was a target of the club's disembodied pranksters.
I was a person who did not believe in ghosts. Absolutely, unequivocally, undeniably, did not believe in any sort of paranormal manifestation. Until I started working here. I was coming in to lock up the main room, and I heard a noise. It was moving just slow, you know, like somebody was just kind of dragging it across the stage, except there was no one there. I'm not a scientist, but it wasn't an earthquake. It wasn't wind. It wasn't a person. It was some supernatural or as yet unexplained force.
Let's get the chairs up, okay?
Blake claims he also witnessed one of Joey Gaynor's misadventures with a supernatural.
A lot of strange stuff going on in this place this week.
I just quit antagonizing him, Joey.
What, when I do this? Hey, come on out. Come on, ghost. Show yourself. Come on, where are you?
I saw this ashtray just go across the room and burst onto the wall. And so Joey says, what was that? What did you throw that at me? And I went, no, it came from over there.
It was like zoom, you know. To see it come up and take off is what was scary.
I was always skeptical because we're talking about comedians telling stories. However, I did see it.
Michael Becker currently handles a Comedy Store's business affairs. It took less than 5 minutes to turn him into a believer.
Definitely.
Yeah, 9 o'clock, MC spot.
Becker says the phantom he saw dropped by in broad daylight, in the middle of an important call, no less.
Yeah, hi, it's Mike Becker. As I was standing there, I saw someone with a kind of a tweed 40s jacket just walk right into my office.
Get that guy in my office. Can you hold, please?
Thanks. Who's that guy?
What guy?
The guy that just came in here. There was nobody there except the guy that was on the phone originally. Nobody came in here.
Nobody.
And to top it off, the guy that was on the phone didn't see anything.
Thanks.
So it was not a guy, but it was something that walked in my office.
That something has been prowling the premises for decades, or so they say. Long before the Comedy Store moved in, these walls were home to the nightclub Ciro's. In the 1940s and 50s, Ciro's was a splashy, flashy playground of movie stars like Tyrone Power, Betty Davis, and Lucille Ball.
Ciro's was the most popular nightclub in Hollywood. And when a club is that popular, the mob is often involved.
Mickey Cohen was the most notorious of the club's gangland regulars. It has long been rumored that a few unfortunate souls who had run-ins with Cohen ended up as ghosts at Ciro's.
It kind of all fits together that something happened back in the 40s, perhaps, because it's never like a hippie-looking guy, or it's never somebody from the 80s, or anything like that. The clothing is always 40s, every time I've ever heard a story.
Once you rule out all the prosaic, logical explanations, such as the hoax, the fraud, misinterpretation of natural events, seismic, transients, electrical transients, you're left with something that is totally inexplicable in terms of modern science.
Modern science would have conniptions trying to explain what Blake Clark claims he and a co-worker saw late one night.
What the?
Do you see that?
Yeah.
We looked back and I saw the gate, and it just started just bending out into the hallway. They're making that kind of noise. And as I was looking at it, I thought, this is certainly approaching the boundary of physical possibility that something can do that.
Most of the ghosts at the Comedy Store are not dangerous at all. But there is something in the basement that is very terrifying. And you'll have a hard time convincing people to go down there, at least alone.
It was a challenge tailor-made for Blake Clark and Joey Gaynor. One time, and one time only, they braved an after-hours visit to the forbidden clutter of the Comedy Store basement.
Hey, look at this, Joey.
Hmm?
It's a checkbook.
Am I anything there for me? Hey, what do you want? What do you want? Just stay back. Just stay back. What do you want? I had no features at all. Just moved, and it started to snake upwards and down towards us.
Spirit, demon, whatever. Whatever was down there in that basement, I just don't like it.
What do you want?
Apparently, the feeling was mutual. For sheer speed, Blake and Joey sprint from the basement as yet to be equaled. A funny thing happened to the comedian of the Comedy Store. When a ghost story begins like that, you're inclined to take it with a grain of salt. But what of the waitresses and employees who have little to gain by telling tall tales? So far, Laurie Jacobson has documented 50 mysterious episodes here at the Comedy Store. Perhaps you should make it 51. Next, during a time of tragic sorrow, a young girl finds comfort in the arms of an unknown Good Samaritan. And later, a joyous reunion rekindles the spirit of a remarkable wartime Christmas. It was a friendship that reached across the generations. 16-year-old Wendy Radcliffe, weathering her parents' stormy divorce, found a best friend and confidant in her grandmother, Bernice Gardner.
There was really unconditional love between us, and she accepted me. It was total acceptance. To spend time with my grandmother was safety. It was kind of like my safety net. Whenever I had problems at home, I went and stayed with her.
How are things with your mom and stepdad?
In 1984, Wendy and her grandmother spent Christmas vacation together in Oregon. On December 30th, they headed back home to Southern California.
Uh-oh. What's wrong? Light just came on. I think we better pull over.
Oh. No one could have foreseen that the minor car problem would trigger a catastrophic series of events. Within hours, Wendy would find herself all alone, facing unbearable sorrow. More than a decade later, Wendy still wants to thank the total stranger who unexpectedly appeared at her side that tragic night in December of 1984.
Okay.
The car repair had derailed Wendy and Bernice's plan to drive home in one day. Wendy called her mother from Modesto, California, to say she and her grandmother would be staying over.
That's it. Hungry?
I'm starving.
The place across the street used to be pretty good. Want to go try it again?
Okay, sure.
Come on. Then we headed out to walk across the street to the restaurant. And I was ahead of her, and I just kind of ran out into traffic and went across the street, and she decided to wait. Just pure horror. I can't describe it any better than that. It was just to see her and to see her looking at me when it happened. It was just pure horror.
Wendy charged into the restaurant, screaming for help. By the time she returned to her grandmother's side, a small crowd had gathered.
And there was a man there, and he kind of pushed me away.
Let go of me! This is my grandmother!
I got the impression that he didn't know who I was. He didn't know that we were related. That he just thought that I was a bystander.
No!
As Wendy watched helplessly, a stranger stepped from the crowd.
This woman just grabbed me and held me and told me it was okay to cry. And tried to tell me everything was going to be okay and, you know, comfort me. She was there. I mean, she reached out to somebody she didn't know and tried to help.
At the hospital, Bernice was rushed to surgery. Wendy was alone again, adrift in a living nightmare.
Dr. Rosa to reception. Dr. Rosa, reception.
Then, out of the blue, a stranger appeared once more.
Hi. How are you doing?
I was very surprised to see her. You know, you just kind of expect people to go on about their life.
What are you doing here?
Well, I couldn't stand to think about you here all night in this hospital all alone. Have you gotten in touch with your family?
Yeah, they're on their way.
Well, how about if I stay with you?
She knew I didn't have any family there, and so she wanted to be with me so that I had somebody there. Somebody that I could look to.
Miss, you can go up and see your grandmother now.
Is she gonna be okay?
She's stable. The doctor will explain everything.
At last, the ordeal seemed to be ending.
I was excited, you know. I thought that I was gonna get to see my grandmother. I thought she was alive and doing okay.
Doctor. Can you tell me which room is Bernice Gardner's? The nurse said we could come in and see her now.
Are you family?
She is.
I'm her granddaughter.
I don't know what they told you downstairs, but I'm afraid you've been misinformed.
And then the lecture, the speech, the one you never want to hear in your life. He had told me that she died, and I just fell apart.
I'm sorry. We did everything we could. I'm very sorry.
There must be some mistake.
Oh, sweet.
The nurse said she was stable.
I know she did. I know.
I cried, and she held me. From that point on, I don't really remember much.
The unknown woman stayed until Wendy's family began to arrive. Then, without a word, she slipped away.
I've looked back on it so many times, and I see over and over and over again how important it was that she was there. Because if she hadn't have been there, I probably would have totally fallen apart.
Today, a decade later, Wendy is a happily married mother of three. But since that night, she has felt a debt of gratitude to the gentle stranger who extended a helping hand.
It was a real turning point for me. She helped me to become a person who can be there for somebody else. And I want her to know that. It means a lot to me to find her.
to let her know that one person made a difference.
When we return, in 1944, a German boy and an American GI shared an unforgettable Christmas dinner. Some 50 years later, our viewers helped reunite them. Tonight we have a heartwarming update to one of our most poignant lost love cases. Perhaps you remember the story. December 1944. Some of the most savage fighting of the Second World War took place in Belgium's Ardennes Forest. Thousands of American and German soldiers would lose their lives in the infamous Battle of the Bulge. Christmas Eve brought no end to the carnage. In an isolated cabin within earshot of the fighting, a young German boy named Fritz Wincken and his mother tried to make the best of the holiday.
Papa?
My mother blew out the candle and went to the door, and I went with her. She opened the door, and there were these soldiers.
We're Americans. And we're lost. And our friend's been shot.
Fritz's mother knew that harboring the enemy was punishable by death. But it was Christmas, and she was willing to take the risk. The GIs had just begun to relax in anticipation of an unexpected holiday meal when there was a knock at the door.
We thought automatically this must be more Americans. And I went to the door and opened the door. And there were four German soldiers.
Fröhliche Weihnachten.
Sie können auch mit uns zu
Abend. No one could have foreseen what happened next. In a remarkable display of courage and compassion, Fritz's mother bid the Germans welcome, provided they leave their weapons at the door. That night, hostilities ceased in at least one corner of the forest. American and German soldiers sat down together to honor the Christmas spirit.
By the time they were all crying, not profusely, but the tears were rolling, you know, even the German sergeant, I was very surprised. And then we ate, and the tears disappeared. But from then on, there was a feeling of friendship that permeated the whole room. It was wonderful. I never forget.
Fritz never did forget the lessons he learned that night. And he never stopped hoping that he would someday be reunited with one of the American GIs. Against all odds, it was a dream that came true. Here's Keeley to tell you how it happened.
Bob, after our most recent broadcast of Fritz's story, a man named Eldridge Ward called our phone center. He's a volunteer chaplain at a nursing home in Frederick, Maryland. Eldridge recognized the story as one often recounted by an elderly resident named Ralph Blank.
We did a little research and found out that in 1944, Ralph Blank had, in fact, been a sergeant serving with the U.S. Army in Belgium. Fritz immediately phoned Ralph, who confirmed that he was one of the soldiers who had celebrated Christmas with Fritz and his mother.
Ralph was completely unaware that we had looked for him. So right away, I asked him whether he remembered me from that night in the Ardennes. Oh, yes, I remember you. He said, you must be Fritz.
On January 19th, 1996, Fritz flew to Maryland to meet his long-lost friend, who is now 76 years old and in fragile health.
I was very excited. I could hardly wait.
That's Ralph.
Fritz!
That's Ralph.
Fritz, I've come to you. What?
That's
Ralph. That's Ralph. I'm glad to see you.
I just had to look at his eyes, and I knew this is him. And he recognized me, apparently. even though we changed so much in that time. But it was a great experience.
And I changed any?
Well, I never thought I'd ever see Fritz again when I left Germany. Today is a special day for me.
The emotional reunion took place just a day after another exciting event, Ralph Blank's 50th wedding anniversary. To cap the joyous celebration, his daughter-in-law fixed the same meal Fritz's mother had served some 52 years ago, a hearty bowl of chicken soup.
I can only tell you it was the fulfillment of a lifelong dream, something I had given up all hope to experience.
Fritz Vinken and Ralph Blank, proof that true friendship and brotherhood can endure time, distance, and the ravages of war.
I had a pistol, you remember?
Yeah.
I gave it to your mother.
That's right. Oh, she took it from you.
She still got my pistol.
Tonight, an urgent appeal to police departments across the country. For nearly a decade, a cunning serial rapist has prowled Buffalo, New York, and his suburbs. Local detectives now fear that the suspect may be targeting women outside the state. Perhaps investigators in other areas can help put an end to the growing list of victims.
I was 17 years old, and I was walking to summer school. I was running a little bit late for school, so I decided to cut through the pass. And I was almost at the end of the path, and I heard something behind me.
Hi, how you doing?
And I didn't think anything of it, so I turned around and I kept walking. You know, I mean, he didn't look like someone I had to fear. He looked like a normal, everyday guy.
Shut up! Don't look at my face.
He started dragging me back into the woods, and then he started strangling me. And then I thought, that's it, I was gonna die. I really thought I'd never see any of my family again. And when he was finished, I asked him what's gonna happen, and he told me, he said nothing. He almost sounded sorry. And then he left.
The reign of terror had only begun. In June of 1988, the rapist was lying in wait as a 16-year-old girl walked to school along an isolated railroad track. Once again, the assailant would double wrap a rope around his victim's neck and tape her eyes shut.
Almost a year later, in May of 1989, another young girl was using this as a shortcut on her way to school. The same individual passed her and immediately afterwards double wrapped a rope around her neck, gained control of her, and took her to the bush area behind me. He forced her to place tape over her eyes, he bound her and sexually assaulted her.
Now there were four. Two of the women said the rapist had worn a blue baseball cap. Each victim described a short, stocky, mustachioed man in his mid-30s. 4 months passed. Then a fifth attack. A woman, alone in a secluded place, early morning.
He placed a rope around her neck. He wrapped it twice. She described him as a very powerful man. He lifted her over this fence and took her into the wooded area over here, where he bound her hands behind her back and he placed surgical tape over her eyes, and at that point, he raped her.
5'5 to 5'8, stocky build, black hair, black mustache, white, possibly Hispanic. It was a rapist, and he would savage two more victims in Amherst.
32-year-old female was using this path early in the morning for exercise. As she got to this point right here, a rope was placed around her neck and she was immediately rendered unconscious. She was then dragged into these woods up this way, which we think was a pre-selected site.
The woman was found 1 hour later, still unconscious. double rap marks on her neck told police who they were dealing with. But this time was different. This time he had nearly killed his victim. ...22-year-old Linda Yalom was a student at the State University in Buffalo when she crossed paths with a rapist. Linda was his seventh known victim. She would be the first to die. Linda Yalom was left in the woods, her mouth and nose wrapped tight with duct tape.
It was premeditated murder. He planned on killing her when he grabbed her that day. Once he put that tape over her nose and her mouth, there was no chance for survival.
An unexpected lull followed. 2, 3, 4 years. Authorities wondered, had the suspect moved, gone to prison, or even perhaps died? Then in October of 1994, a 14-year-old girl was raped in Buffalo, New York. He was back.
This guy strikes so infrequently, he's very hard to profile. Very, very difficult. He's either got tremendous self-control or else he's hitting in other parts of the country that we're not aware of.
In a moment, the mysterious case of Keith Warren. Did a killer cleverly arrange Keith's death scene to make it look like suicide? The 911 call came in just before 2 p.m. on July 31st, 1986. A mother's quiet world was about to be shattered. Her only son was dead. Keith Warren was just 1 month from starting college. He had lived with his sister and mother since his parents divorced when he was 10. By all accounts, a well-liked and dependable young man, Keith seemed destined for a promising future. Instead, he had come to an untimely end. Paramedics found Keith in a wooded area behind his family's townhouse. He was hanging by the neck from a small tree that was bent double with his weight. The elaborate arrangement of the hanging rope would later be the source of bitter debate. The cord was anchored around the base of a large tree. It extended some 25 feet to a small sapling. It encircled the sapling's trunk and then arched up through a fork. The authorities, however, saw nothing suspicious about the scene. After a brief visual inspection, the county's deputy medical examiner determined that Keith Warren had committed suicide. No autopsy was ordered, and the body was dispatched to a funeral home for embalming. It was already dark when Keith's mother was informed.
I didn't realize at the time that Keith's body was not in a morgue. There'd been no investigation, and his body had been discovered maybe 5 or 6 hours earlier, about 12:30. I didn't know at the time the officer had chosen a funeral home.
A few days later, Mary Cooey received her son's personal effects, some audio tapes, a jacket, and his trademark brown boots.
I saw the boots, and that's when I just got really, I knew it was all over to see the boots. That was Keith, and that was it.
Initially, Keith's mother accepted the finding of suicide. But over time, she found discrepancies too numerous to ignore. Today, Mary Cooey totally rejects the official explanation. Her doubts began after she heard from a friend of Keith's named Rodney Kendall. Rodney reported that a parade of suspicious characters had been looking for Keith shortly before his death.
Hey, yo, dude. You seen Keith Warren around? Do you know him?
No, why? What's up?
Nothing much, man. Just some friends looking for him. See him around?
The first incident occurred in front of the townhouse a week before Keith's body was found.
Why? What are you looking for him for?
It was mainly black males that were in the car. And Keith did not associate much with black males. Most of his friends were white males. So I thought that was pretty strange. And after I told them that I hadn't seen Keith, they left.
He said they weren't from the neighborhood or our school area. So I kind of figured, why would they be looking for Keith? But, no one had an answer for me.
Several days later, Rodney had another odd encounter, this time with a high school acquaintance of Keith's named Mark Finley.
Rodney, have you seen Keith?
Oh, man, what's up?
I need to find him. When was the last time you saw him?
I don't know. We were out last night.
What
the last time?
I saw him. When?
He seemed pretty urgent. I thought it was pretty strange because he acted like he needed to find Keith very quickly. And I told him I didn't know where Keith was, and he left.
And that puzzled me, because I said, in the past seven, eight years we lived in Maryland, Mark never came by, nor did he ever call for Keith. I never saw him in house. I don't recall him. And my last recollection of Mark was when we were in eighth grade, and they got into a fight, Keith and Mark did.
A couple of weeks after that, my mom came to visit me, and I've never gone to the site that the tree was found, and she wanted to go to the tree.
Rodney Kendall, who had earlier identified Keith's body for the police, led the way.
When we got there, I looked around and couldn't find the tree, but I was sure I was in the right spot. And we looked down and the tree had been cut down. It was just the stump left.
I panicked and I called the police, and they're very rude. That really told me that, well, what do you want us to do? Yeah, we cut it down. What do you want us to do about it?
Mary Betters and a multiracial community group known as CLAMS are helping Keith's mother with a case.
The police had cut down the tree, and they were saving it as evidence. Now, this was a big surprise to us because heretofore they had said that the case was closed. And we were surprised that they would be still collecting and saving evidence.
Keith's mother no longer trusted the police or their explanations. She launched a letter-writing campaign targeting state and federal officials. But for 6 long years, Mary Cooey hit a stone wall every way she turned. Then came April 9th, 1992, her son's birthday. Keith would have been 25. That afternoon, Mary found a plain manila envelope at her doorstep. The stunning contents would sweep her back to the day of her son's death.
Oh, Sherry! Oh, my God!
And Sherry came up, and she saw the pictures scattered, and she picked them up. And, of course, she panicked. And then she says, oh, my God, this is Keith.
There were 5 pictures in all. They looked official, and each showed a different view of Keith Warren hanging by his neck. Mary forced herself to look, and in the process, she found a glaring discrepancy.
Those are not his shoes.
His clothing, it didn't fit him. That's when we started to realize he was wearing somebody else's clothing. He's got a long-sleeve shirt on, looks fairly new. He's got, like, corduroy jeans on that he didn't own. But the real eye catcher was that he was wearing white sneakers.
And those white tennis shoes, he did not own. He did not own a pair of white tennis shoes.
For Mary Cooey, it was a nightmarish inconsistency. Yes, that was her son in the photographs. But whose clothes was he wearing? Whose white tennis shoes? And why was he wearing them? The only items of clothing the police returned to the family had been Keith's jacket and brown boots. Neither was shown in the photographs, although authorities said that they had been found near Keith's body.
My brain started to just really go into a tailspin, because I didn't feel that the police were my friends at all. I started to talk around to legal people, and I was advised to go to a local investigator and find out the source of the photos.
The police department conceded that they were copies of original police photos, but they had no idea where they came from, none whatsoever. They were questioned numerous times.
When Joe Alercia examined the pictures, he noticed leaves on the back of Keith's shirt. To Alercia, this suggests that Keith had been lying on the ground and was hoisted into a hanging position by someone else. Alercia says that his theory is bolstered by the complex path of the rope found at the scene.
Apparently, the perpetrators noticed that the tree was small and wouldn't hold the body, therefore they needed some security by tying around a big tree here.
When you talk to police off the record, you get this was a travesty of errors. On the record, you get a lot of there are logical explanations for everything, and yet no logical explanations have ever been given. The fact of the matter is no one seems to know whose clothing Keith Warren is wearing in those photographs and whether or not Keith Warren was hanged or whether or not he committed suicide.
Finally, Keith's family had his body exhumed. At long last, there was an autopsy, and the results were shocking.
I believe that Keith Warren's death being listed as suicide is medically not supportable.
Toxicology tests had revealed the presence of potent chemicals, most importantly trichloroethane or TCE. They are usually found in glue and solvents. The levels found in Keith Warren were more than enough to kill him.
These substances can get in there by inhalation, or they could be actually even be taken in by mouth. The other possibility, of course, is injection as part of an embalming solution.
The embalming process is exactly how Maryland's chief medical examiner explained away the toxic chemicals when he reviewed the autopsy report. Dr. Mihalikas disagrees.
The substances found in Keith Warren's body could not have been introduced by the embalming fluid because, one, the embalmer in his report never mentioned using any of those substances. Secondly, the distribution of the key substance trichloroethane is more consistent with inhalation. And third, there were found two additional substances which are totally unrelated to any embalming solution.
He could have been at a party with some drugs involved and he accidentally killed himself. And they were afraid, and then they decided to take and hang him, make it look like a suicide, okay? Or he could have been attacked from the back, and that particular chemical is so potent that one chemist said that he was dead before he hit the ground.
He couldn't have done this and placed himself on the tree. That's the bottom line. He could not have taken these chemicals and then hung himself.
If Keith Warren didn't hang himself, then who did hang him? In a final disturbing twist, the one person who might have answered that question has also turned up dead under suspicious circumstances. Mark Finley was one of those who came looking for Keith around the time he died. 6 years later, when Mary Cooey received the photographs, Finley again figured prominently. Affixed to one of the pictures was a threatening note which appeared to target Finley and another man. The note read in part, "Don't worry, Mark Finley will be next." 2 months after Mark learned he had been singled out, he contacted Mary Cooey.
Mark called my residence, left a message on my answer machine to the effect of something that said, "Miss Warren, this is Mark Finley. I got your message, and I will be by to see you." I do remember the specific words, but "I need to unload."
1 month later, Mark Finley was dead. According to the Montgomery County Police, Finley died accidentally when he struck a curb and was thrown from his bike.
That was a strange death. The original ambulance crew said the damage to Mr. Finley didn't fit the accident itself. The damage in his face, it was looked like somebody either hit him with a car or he was waiting for him with a baseball bat and hit him with a baseball bat. Mark Finley made a statement at a party saying that Keith didn't kill himself. I helped hang him in the tree. It just seemed kind of strange that he happened to expire when he had made that statement.
Why was Mark Finley targeted in a threatening note? Did he truly have information about Keith Warren's death? As with all the other nagging questions, the authorities have a standard answer. This case is closed.
We're still being stonewalled, and we're still being fought. And that's incredible. I can't understand that. What is it that the system does not want me to know about my child's life or death?
Despite repeated requests, officials in Montgomery County, Maryland, declined to comment on the case or participate in this broadcast. Mary Cooey vows that she will continue to press her own investigation until each and every question about her son's death has been answered. Join me again next Friday. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery. Thank you.